Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Kyle Hopkins of the Anchorage Daily News, and Dacia Eaton of KSKA Radio. Big news here in Anchorage this week is the continuing debate over the municipal election. The Anchorage Assembly certifies the municipal election pending a recount. Dacia, you were there last night, that last night in this case being Thursday night, as the Assembly debated and heard some contrary views and quite a bit happened. Tell us about it.
Yes, it was a ruckus and rowdy Assembly meeting. The people from the audience were yelling and shouting. The Ernie Hall, the chair, decided not to take public comment, but the public decided to comment anyway. They decided to certify the election, and it is pending a recount. So, but they're only going to recount, I think it's 15 precincts. They have to do that within 7 days.
And there was a citizens group came up forward and asked for the recount, which Hall, now Assemblymember Hall, the chairman, says will be done by hand. And they paid $100 per 15 for each precinct, right? So $1,500 to get 15 precincts.
That's right. 10 citizens came forward and submitted an official application, I believe it was Wednesday, just before the Assembly meeting to get the recount. So 15 precincts, they chose 15 precincts where there were some clear issues, irregularities, and they should begin that recount shortly.
Okay, and a former election coordinator, Merriquin, had an op-ed piece in the paper. She's been widely quoted and expressing dissatisfaction with the way the election was conducted.
Yes, she had a bunch of concerns. I interviewed her this week. She said one main concern was how the voting machines were treated and how the cards that go in them were treated. I guess there were reports of some seals being broken, although the Election Commission says they don't have any official reports of that. And she's concerned that there were seals broken and that there were some irregularities with the voting machines. Also, there was once a data processing review board. Nobody else has really talked about this, but she did speak about it with me. And that was eliminated in 2010, and she said it was because state law changed, and so they changed the municipal process. She believes that data processing review board, which was made up of technology professionals who marked and tested the ballots, should be reinstated. And because it's gone, she thinks perhaps this is why we had such a clumsy election.
Okay. Steve McDonald, what is Attorney Tim Petunin's role in this? He'd been hired by Ernie Hall and brought into look at certain things. So what was he asked to do?
Basically be the legal advisor for the Assembly and over this decision of whether they should certify the election or not. He basically came back to them and said, you've got to certify this at this particular point in time. You can't put this off. It is the law. You'd be in violation of the state constitution. He kind of guided them through this legal maze surrounding the election and what they should do. In the end, I think there were three Assembly members. I think it went 8-3 in favor of certification. Patrick Flynn, he said, I have the choice to do what's right or what's legal, and he voted against certification. So that was probably the big takeaway quote from last night during that debate with the Assembly. But Bituminous basically was the fellow who said, you got to certify, not for Ernie Hall. He still says he wants to go out and hire an independent investigator to look into what happened on April 3rd, and that'll be a whole nother process.
What I'd wondered about is the recount of how long that might take. By hand, they would have to bring in people who, I've seen it done. It's a fairly laborious process, and it's certainly going to cost more than $100. On the other hand, if it satisfies people, there's a definite benefit to it.
And I think that's what you have to look at. Right now, the public's faith largely has been damaged when it comes to the city holding an election. turnouts have been slipping over the years. Each election cycle, it seems like there's less turnout each time. People have a myriad of excuses for not casting ballots, for not turning out, and then you have something like this happen, and it damages the faith of the public at large. So I think whatever the city has to do to make sure that this is a strong system, a system that has integrity, it's got to do it to restore the faith.
Why just 15 precincts?
I believe they had to pay.
They did. That's all they could afford.
My understanding, after talking to one of the people who was involved in one of the signers of the petition, and somebody put up $100, is they realized that if you were going to request a recount, there was a deadline, and it was coming up very quickly. So it became, how many people can we get in a room who have $100 and are willing to sign this petition demanding a recount?
So you really got to hand it to those citizens who just decided to take matters into their own hands. And take out their checkbooks. I mean, a lot of people just wish they would have done the hand recount anyway, mm-hmm. considering the circumstances.
Well, the other thing is, it's been pointed out several times by several people, and I think on the show as well, the state of Alaska requires, I believe it's one precinct recounted in every legislative district, every house district during their state elections. That's a requirement for the state. And so some people are saying, well, why doesn't the municipality have that? Kyle, mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to you. You had, we're talking about the election commission, here, citizens group to oversee elections, and you had some observations given your experience as a reporter.
Just questions. I don't have additional information to provide.
Okay,
I was surprised. All I was saying was I was surprised when the election commission report came out. For one thing, I was surprised how detailed it was because I got the impression that they weren't considering themselves an investigative body and they weren't trying to kind of solve the riddle of what happened, and they went, a third or a half of the way there. They made an attempt, right? And one of their conclusions was that more than half of the precincts ran dry of ballots, and that was a lot more than we were hearing before from the clerk's office. And I still don't understand what the difference was, if that was just based on interviews with election workers or voters themselves. And then the other thing that just seemed noteworthy is the fact that, we're talking about Lupe Mariquin, and the letter that she wrote and what she's been saying about the election. Well, just the fact that it's worth noting that her job doesn't exist anymore. That there was, this was an election supervisor that, when I started covering elections in Anchorage, that she was kind of the election czar. And if it was 9 o'clock and you had a question, you'd call her cell phone and she just seemed to be kind of shepherding the election. And she retired in like, or left, maybe she didn't retire, maybe she's forced out, but she left in like 2009, 2010, and then was never replaced. And if you talk to assembly members who were on the assembly at the time, they say that the clerk's office said, it's all right, we'll just absorb the loss of that person and we'll just kind of share, we'll spread we don't need someone specifically for that duty. And then, but if you ask the clerk's office now, they'll say, well, that was a joint decision, that others were involved in that decision. But just the fact that there used to be an election supervisor, now there's not really, that seems fairly important, given the boondoggle.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing that you're going to have to, if you're the city, if you're the assembly, the mayor, I think those are the kinds of things that you're going to have to consider, again, to restore faith and integrity, that you're going to have somebody looking over the system like Lupe did in the years past.
It does seem that conspiracy theories thrive in environments in which what is presented as the simple, direct, and obvious explanation is not believed. In this case, what? You didn't send enough ballots to the precincts?
Yeah.
It's got to be something else than that. How could that be? Maybe that's what we're talking about here, Steve.
Yeah. Well, again, do you have faith in the system? That's what it kind of all boils down to. So they didn't put out enough ballots. Okay, what's the next jump? Is it a bag of ballots in the trunk of somebody's car, that didn't get counted or whatever? They thrive in that.
A couple things. One is, again, we're back to this, the number of people who may have been deprived the opportunity to vote is unknowable, right?
Yes. We have no idea. Mm-hmm. There has not been an independent investigation. Will we ever know who was, all the number of people who were deprived of voting? Probably
well,
not.
Well, and then it gets immensely complicated because there may have been people who said, I'm not voting, told somebody as they were leaving, I can't vote, then decided, no, I'm going to go over to some other precinct, and they did vote. So, you know, the anecdotal stuff here is very difficult, too. But I wanted to ask you, what about the special counsel, Daisha, that Assembly Chair Ernie Hall has in mind? Because this is somehow proving elusive. You'd think that person would be on the job by now.
You would think so. I spoke with Ernie at the assembly meeting where they certified the election, and right after the meeting, and he said, you know, we're in the final negotiations, we're just working out the details. He said that it will happen as soon as possible, maybe even, you know, this week.
Okay, and we'll see. Kyle, the case of missing Airman Clinton Reeves, this is particularly unusual because the military usually knows where, especially when they're on duty, where their men are. The men and women are, if not 24 hours a day, certainly every morning when they call them out. What is happening, and how does a person become, how long do you have to be gone before the word missing can be applied to you?
Well, when you asked that question earlier today, you saw me call the police and ask that question, and because I think like a lot of people had this assumption that there's this 24-hour limbo period where if my... you know, my 13-year-old daughter goes missing and I report it to police and they say, you know what, 24 hours from now, here, okay, we'll start the clock and 24 hours from now we'll deal with that. And apparently that used to be the case, but the police said that's no longer the case, that they, first of all, it kind of depends on the context of, you know, who the person is and the context of how they went missing and their patterns and whatnot, but that there's no longer this day-long period where they kind of don't consider that person missing, that they're considered missing as soon as they're reported missing. And then what the police do about that depends on what they're being told. If it's, you know, if it's, you know, 75-year-old grandma and she has Alzheimer's and she's wandered off, then they, you know, that person is missing, they're going to look for that. If it's like, you know, if it's a relative that you haven't heard from in a couple weeks who you kind of, you know, has been couch surfing, they're not going to do much about it immediately. And in this case, it was the guy, you know, the fact that he's an airman and yeah, he's expected to be somewhere every weekday. You know, it didn't help that it was over the weekend. He leaves, right? He's last seen at work and then there's the weekend and then but he's not calling mom and he doesn't show up for work on Monday. And then the police are still not really considering it. They're not really actively looking into it as a criminal case.
Well, it's also, if I might, it becomes there a jurisdictional matter because, first of all, the service is going to be involved, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Air Force security, I mean, military security, you know, I don't know much about that process. I mean, you would imagine he'd be considered AWOL or they'd be looking into that. But then they find his car. They find the rental car, and it's got his belongings in it. And at that point, the homicide team and missing persons team gets involved. You don't hear as much about that case. I mean, you've got a kind of a young 20-something guy who's missing. His car's there. He's not. No one knows where he is. That's a pretty big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and clearly the missing car is evidence of something significant. I mean, they found the car and they can't find him.
All his belongings were inside the car, right? I mean, it was as if he had just been sitting there and gotten up and walked.
Yeah,
away.
I don't think it's true that his keys were in the car. I think that's not right. But I do. But like his uniform and you know some groceries, and that's a rental car. I mean, who's going to leave their rental car unlocked and walk away from it for days?
Thank you, Kyle. Steve, the special session is really over. It's finally over, and
I don't
the
back know.
Boxes
are you sure?
have been sent home. People, the legislators are home. How to summarize?
It was good for a few laughs. How to summarize this thing? Well, they solved the human trafficking issue, so that was, you know, one out of three ain't bad, you know. But nothing.
Well, isn't there even an argument there that they may not have because did it pass the special session properly? And there's some discussion of that.
Well, I didn't
mean to rain on your
parade. No, no, I was celebrating that one win for them. But the other issues regarding energy, the oil tax reduction proposed by Governor Parnell, and then the gas pipeline issue too, unresolved, weren't really addressed at all. House members felt that there was just no way these issues were going to go anywhere in the Senate. The governor felt the same way, and they called it a session. These are two pressing issues. You know, we talked a couple of weeks ago, or maybe it was last week, about how soaring energy prices in the interior and out in the villages, tremendous issue that needs to be addressed. And again, the legislature didn't really advance this at all. The lawmakers blame the administration, the Parnell administration, for not giving them good answers to base a decision on. And we were talking about the blame game, I think, a week or so ago, too, about whose fault it is. It kind of falls on everybody, I think, in the legislature that these things didn't, and in the governor's office that these things weren't addressed.
Kyle, I was just thinking here, something occurred to me. You've lived in Fairbanks. You have quite a bit of experience. How many years have you been away from our fair city, the Golden Heart City of the Interior? A few years now. Were the energy price discussions, fuel oil, heating oil, what it pays to heat my house, were they as intense when you were living there as they are now? It seems like you can't pick up the Newsminer or watch television there without there being some discussion of this.
Yeah, I remember at that time I personally didn't care because I was like, I went to college there, and then I had a little apartment there, you know, and I don't remember what I paid for utilities, but it wasn't like it being a homeowner. But seriously, like, there wasn't that kind of discussion. It seemed like 07, 08, the big deal was Bush energy prices, right? How much are people paying in the Bush? And then the last couple of years, like the prices that you're hearing in Fairbanks, like I don't remember ever hearing people complain about that. Because you would hear it just, you know, talking to your friends, and it was never as bad as what's being described now.
Well, apparently that some people have paid as much as $6,000 to said that, and it turns out to be true, to heat their house for a winter. On the other hand, I've had economists down here in Anchorage argue that housing is cheaper in Fairbanks. Their mortgage prices might be low.
You know, it doesn't help anyone immediately, but it does make you wonder about what opportunities there are for folks like the Cold Climate Research Center up there and stuff, like people who are like researching, okay, how do we live in this super cold place, let's keep the heat inside, you know, so we don't have to pay to kind of keep heat in the place. And you know, when you talk to those guys, they have a lot of ideas. It would, just like the Bush, it would, like, who's going to pay? Who's going to pay for those new homes? Who's going to pay to insulate all the
homes? I can chime in about the Bush.
Yeah, please do. Tell us about Dillingham.
Spent a year in Dillingham. You know, I was living in a home which one of our heating bills came back over $1,500 for 1 month this winter. It was 30 below a lot of the winter. Frightening.
This past winter
was very cold, and that's fairly typical for a lot of homeowners.
For what kind of heat?
Not a huge house.
Fuel oil?
Yes. So, I mean, think about that.
A lot of wearing sweaters indoors.
Yeah, wearing sweaters indoors, keeping the heat down. I mean, we were being pretty careful, over $1,500.
Yeah. Well, we were up in Fairbanks a few weeks ago preparing for a show that we did last night, but it was... We heard on a regular basis $600-$800 a month that people in Fairbanks, fairly good sized city, and connected by roads with a refinery right there in the backyard, and still paying hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month for heating and to keeping their home. And that's a real, you know, hit on the wallet.
Steve, there is one development now that's new since, in particular, since the legislature went home. It was released that the Parnell administration, the legislature, wants to send the major gas line, the home heating or the natural gas pipeline for domestic use, but for foreign use, South Central or Nikiski or Valdez or someplace, and we're going to export it to the Far East. Is this going to happen?
Who knows? I don't know. These ideas get floated, and who knows if they happen. But this one seems to have a lot of momentum. Governor Parnell really brought this up into last year and said, you know, there's a market in Asia, Japan. We should be aiming there. And The producers seem to really get excited about this. TransCanada seemed to get excited. They're the company, of course, that's been contracted by the state to look into the feasibility of building a pipeline from Prudhoe Bay down into the lower 48 and connecting with the pipelines down there. There's an influx of cheaper gas down in the lower 48, so it's not financially feasible to build this line, according to many experts. So when Governor Parnell brought this option up, it seemed to catch fire. So they are now officially looking at this particular option. The idea is either go to Nikiski, where ConocoPhillips has a gas liquefaction plant, maybe too small capacity, they may have to expand it, or maybe even build a brand new one, a larger facility. They may decide to go to Valdez, where you've got, you know, again, a port in existence there. They'd have to build a plant there to chill this gas and then ship it overseas. But
and they'd need a variety of federal permits from Congress and FERC and
But TransCanada has already started in on that a little bit. I mean, I think that those things are applicable now, that they could, if they wanted to change the route of this pipe, I think that they can start moving some of that paperwork over there. So I'm not going to lose too much. But I do believe, if I've read correctly, that it's a two-year, they've pushed the deadline now back like 2 years for having this information. It was supposed to be sometime this fall or winter that TransCanada was going to have a report on connecting into the pipeline system in the lower 48. That's been pushed back now so they can study this.
At the risk of being busted for being disrespectful of the legislature and perhaps others, this is taking on a certain Monty Python aspect of to Chicago. No. Nikiski.
Yeah, yeah.
What about Valdez? Yes, Valdez. I know people are dead serious about this, but it also involves a lot of money and a lot of time.
And there's competition out there, too, and that's just it. They talk about Australia and China maybe supplying gas for the Pacific Rim. So are they moving faster? Are they further ahead on a project than we are? We seem to be notorious for dragging our feet on these types of things. And I can understand why, too. State-backed projects don't have a real good track record here in the state of Alaska. Ask the folks in the interior how those barley farms are going. So I think some folks are kind of gun shy, especially when you're talking about billions of dollars.
Thank you, Steve. Mm-hmm. Kyle, we had a tragedy in the past few days. A mother ran over her child. It was well covered in the newspaper and also especially on television. Inevitably, some members of the public are unhappy with the coverage. Tell us about the event, the coverage, and the kind of criticism you've heard.
I believe it was Monday, right? That
yes.
In East Anchorage, there was a mother who was taking her mother to an appointment. Was leaving in the family Toyota minivan. Thought her 1-year-old daughter Vanessa was in the trailer, and the people inside the trailer thought that Vanessa was in the trailer too. They didn't realize that the girl had kind of toddled off after mom and grandma. And so it's one of these things that seems to happen maybe every couple years or so, where a parent or a family member, you know, runs over the child, knew it immediately, but the girl died at the hospital maybe within an hour or so. And I covered the initial incident was there and talking to neighbors, and it's a big family, a Hmong family that I think the mom maybe worked at McDonald's, was clearly distraught over losing her daughter, but kind of unclear what had happened, the language barrier, and plus the police tape's still up, and so everyone did their stories. I mean, some of the feedback I got was whenever there's an accident like that, or whenever there's a, kind of a tragic death, people are always, they're always turned off by certain details and stories. They don't want to know. Some people don't want to know. They don't want you to say that the mom didn't appear to be drinking or doing drugs, or maybe had a valid license, because of the implication, that just implies something. But of course, you include that kind of thing because in the absence of that information, people wonder. I mean, they do want to, if you don't say it, then people will wonder about it. you know, and then subsequently over the week, I think there was just criticism of, you know, leave the family alone, don't go talk to the family. And, you know, I didn't do that particular story this week. But, you know, the thing that you always tell people, of course, is that, well, you know, in some cases, not all cases, certainly some people don't want a camera in their face, but some people do. I mean, you know, it's always surprising how often that's the case, that some people, you know, when they lose a loved one, they do want to talk about it. And that's, I don't know. I mean, when I make those phone calls, that's usually how I couch it, is I say, you know, I understand if you don't want to talk to me, but if you want to tell people about so-and-so, you know, I would like to talk to you. And then, and sometimes people do. And I think this is one of the cases where they did. I mean, that's a family that has asked for help paying for the funeral, I believe. Today I did a Rod Musher, this is Friday, right? So today I did a Rod Musher. Zoya Denure has been calling around to see if they still need that help. She wants to help pay for it. She has a small, she has a daughter, a small daughter of her own.
So. And there are ways to do this respectfully, and sometimes it's, you know, I've seen on New York television, Mrs. Gonzalez, Jose fell down the elevator shaft. How was it? And she's sobbing uncontrollably.
Yeah, I mean, I think the trick is not to be coy and say, well, I'm just asking these questions because just for you, family, because I want, you know, because that's not really why. I mean, the reason you're doing it is because you're doing your job and reporting the news, and people, when something happens like that that's very public and people have questions and you want to provide those answers, but there is a way to be, you know, kind of just professional about it and sensitive about it and ask in respectful, yeah.
Professionally, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.